You're listening to Opera Box Score.
Let's get ready to rumble!
Wherever you are, however you're listening, it's America's talk radio show about opera. It's Opera Box Score. I am George Cedarquist, joined by Oliver Camacho and Weston Williams. All right, this week we go inside the huddle with Hera Haesang Park. The South Korean soprano's sophomore album was just released, and keeping with the theme of the show, she tells us about how she was photographed freediving for the album cover.
Amazing.
Plus, in the two-minute drill, okay, Swifties got the Eras tour, the Beehive got the Renaissance tour, look out, opera fans, Kathleen Battle is back with the Battle Fatigue tour. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on Spotify. You click follow. Apple Podcasts, hit that plus sign. Oh, hey, look, send us a voice memo or even just email us your hot takes, mailbag@operaboxscore.com. You can even just record your thoughts using the You Got Something to Say tab on our website. It's operaboxscore.com. However you contribute, you're going to get that OBS beer coaster, the OBS lapel pin, and the number one OBS fan foam finger just for sharing your own hot take. It's so great to be back on the show and sharing the air with Oliver Camacho.
It's a very exciting week for tennis. I know that tennis season really never ends, but it feels like it doesn't anyway. It was, in fact, quite exciting because Carlos Alcaraz, my hero, is seeming to recapture the form that he had that allowed him to win Wimbledon last year. And in beating the Italian Jannik Sinner in the semifinals, maintained his number two ranking. That was the most exciting match of the championship weekend. Jannik Sinner destroyed him in the first set, but he bounced back and beat Sinner 6-3, 6-2 in sets 2 and 3. And it was sort of embarrassing for Daniil Medvedev, who should be a stronger rival to Alcaraz. But after losing the tiebreak, he just kind of just gave up. And the second set was 6-1. So 7-6, 6-1 for the final match of the Indian Wells Championship. It's a 1,000 level Masters. And in winning this one, Carlos Alcaraz joins a very elite group of two people who have won five Masters titles while they were still 20 years old. Yeah, that other person is Rafael Nadal.
Yeah.
And coming up this week, it's the Miami Open, which makes with the Indian Wells what they call the Sunshine Double. Aww. We have no sunshine in Chicago, but they have it over there in Miami.
Weston Williams, there he is. Great to see you too, my friend.
I am indeed here, and it's good to see you too, George. You know, for the past, 6 weeks, I have been doing my best George impression every single time.
It's been marvelous.
But every time people listen, they come up to me in the street and they say, Weston, you just sound too tall. It's not quite
Ouch.
The same.
I've been working hard over a Kurt Weill opera. I was directing a production of Street Scene, which, let me
Good
say
show.
So. It's a great show. It's got to be one of like the three hardest shows in the repertoire for a director. There are so many darn people on that stage.
It's New York City, George.
But I survived.
The Big Apple.
It was totally great. It's totally great to be back here as well. Let us talk some opera.
Huddle up. Let's go inside the huddle.
So as George mentioned at the top, Breathe is the second album released by Hera Haesang Park. Her first was called I Am Hera. And this new album has a very specific theme. And the press release about this album, and even like the notes from Hera Haesang Park herself, are very cerebral. And it's about like coming out of COVID, and it's about like, you know, resilience and despair, but triumph over despair through meditation and prayer. And the album is a mood. The whole thing is a mood. And there's a lot of like new music on here, but there's also some stuff that fits the theme, like the Lakme duet, which is a good excuse to bring on Emily D'Angelo, and the Ave Maria from Verdi's Otello. Not sure if Hera Haesang Park is ever going to sing Desdemona. That's not her voice, but It's surprising how much she's willing to push her basically lyric color to a voice into more full lyric repertoire for this album. We'll start with a little example from the album. This is the prayer from Rossini's The Siege of Corinth. First of all, welcome to Opera Box Score. It's so exciting to meet you. And when we had our conversation for WFMT, you said something to me that I wanted to ask you more about, but it wasn't the right platform. But you reminded me that you are the first Asian artist, vocal artist, to have a contract as a exclusive Deutsche Grammophon recording artist. And that's something to celebrate, but 100%. it's also something I think that's embarrassing for the classical recording industry, don't you think?
100%, yeah.
I mean, where is Ying Fang's recording contract?
Absolutely, she's also a good friend of mine, and we also share the same teacher, and my teacher used to tell me that. I really wish you both are mixed in between. But I told myself that if I don't believe Jesus, I'll believe her, because her voice is like coming from the heaven. And I always thought like she has the most beautiful angelic voice. And she's so great. And there are so many wonderful Asian or like any other country's singers. I hope it's just only the beginning and many more to come.
Are you friends with Mei Gui Zhang?
Yes. We also share the same teachers. It's all like the same roots, right? It's incredible how small the world is.
Mm-hmm. It would be interesting one day, because I could tell that your voice is, has a lot of color and a lot of potential to have you as the Contessa and Ying as Susanna. Maybe Megui singing Barbarina or Cherubino or something.
Yes, 100%.
All Asian rock star Mary Figaro. Or Rosenkavalier, maybe. So
interesting.
When we were talking earlier, you were talking about humility and being modest, and maybe that is a cultural stereotype for Asian people, maybe even specifically Korean, to have humility. But how you feel that in order for you to be authentic, you have to sort of overcome this and be more proud and be more, the word is, we say in your face, it's not really a great expression because it sounds aggressive, but just being more open and being more, showing more of yourself than most people would dare to show.
Why is it aggressive to say being open?
Oh, no, being in your face. That expression is, in your face makes it sound like, you want people to see who you are, like, damn it,
I see. Well, it took so long time to really reveal myself to the world. In Korea, it was really difficult because of the downism that we have, or like all the stereotype of how to behave in a certain ways. But then when I was in, when I went to study in America, it was shocking that, well, how people are expressing themselves and without any fear, and communicating with the professor without worrying, even like putting their hands in their pockets and then like make a big discussion with the professor. That was shocking for me. But then I understand that it's just like, it's okay, you know? Like, they were not offended. The professor were not offended by seeing the student putting their hands in the pocket and then like questioning, like, oh, I don't think this is like what I think. Like, maybe I have a different idea. And they were sharing the idea, and it was so interesting. So I tried to become foreigner, and that was my big mistake. The more I tried to become one of them, I realized that I started to losing who I am. And it was so confusing. And that was the moment when I was at the mat, and I was somewhere in between, like not even an Asian or not even a Westerners. It was so bizarre stage. And then my teacher told me that, like, why are you using always the conditional tense when you're speaking in English? I should have done this better, or like, if I were, or blah, 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 I could have been better with this. She asked me, what if you use the present tense instead of I should have or could have? And that's the place where she put it on the wall, I am, and then blank, and fill out this sentence based on what you just said. And I didn't know what is she trying to say. But then after like big silence, she wrote enough. And that was a big hit for me. And well, I forgot that I am just enough as who I am. And it's okay if I have to put 10 times more extra effort to be on the same stage with the others. I should, because I'm not from Italia, where the operatic singing came initially, or I'm not European, I'm not like English speaker, but I'm just Korean, but it's still okay because I'm enough as who I am. If it requires more effort, I'm gonna do it more. And that really changed everything. And I stopped being a pleaser, stopped to be fitting. I rather just tried to listen my own soul and my spirit and my own energy. Do I feel comfortable? Am I okay? Am I in peace? Am I being able to control where am I right now? And answering all those questions that I had inside in me. And if I say yes, then I went for it. And that really made me much, much mature woman and comfortable in singing and technique, everything. If you are trying to become someone else, especially in this business, you really ruin your voice also. You can really harm yourself to the most. And that was a big lesson that I've ever had. And since then, I'm really not afraid of showing who really I am and being vulnerable, because I really think this is the most powerful thing, to be able to be vulnerable in front of the people.
Well, you've touched on so many ideas here, but I want maybe to understand your experience as a Korean person working in the West, especially in America, and how Korean women, or how Korean people in general, are might be perceived by your Western colleagues, and what you would like to say to just, you know, refute some of these stereotypes or these preconceptions that people might have about you just because of your ethnicity or your nationality. Is there anything that you wish, like, oh, gosh, this again? that's frustrating maybe for you, that we could all learn from you today?
Yes, absolutely. This stereotype thingy that I'm coming from Asia, small girl who's supposed to sing the high coloratura stuff because I'm little. Mm-hmm. And so I was forcing my voice because I wanted to make that happen, because I believed them more than believing my own self, because mm-hmm. I thought they're more knowledgeable, they're more experienced. So like when they're giving me to sing like Queen of the Night or like Entfühlung Constanz or La Fée from Saint-Étienne, I pushed myself to sing all this high stuff, but I was never comfortable. But I made it because I'm a hard worker and I'm pushing myself to the limit, but I was never comfortable. And that's really a big mistake. And I don't want any other followers, another singer in the next generation making the same mistake that I did. I really wish them to listen their own body and their own gut and still trust in yourself more than anybody's, because the more you make your career, there will be more people on your plates, more chefs to want to, like, there'll be a lot of people around you. And I don't mean that we should ignore them. I think they're really amazing and their intention is so great. I mean, they're all very, very knowledgeable people and they have their own reason to say this. But if you feel uncomfortable, even though you're working so hard, even though you're practicing like crazy all night, and when everyone is going back home, like if you are the one who is constantly being in the practice room and suffering, but then stop suffering and find another way and listen to your own gut and listen to your own body, then it will be much, much easier and people are going to come back to you because you trust yourself. There's nothing better than that.
When we were talking earlier, I was asking you about your willingness to be so open about how this album came to be, how you selected the repertoire, and how you tried to get, you know, to the essence of each piece through studying maybe the history of the piece or the history of the text, or with working with the composer directly. And it feels like you really are allowing yourself to be vulnerable and allowing yourself to share a lot of your personal life with your audience, which I don't imagine a lot of opera singers feel comfortable doing, because they want the art to speak for itself. And also it's personal, you know, and like how we touch an emotion and try to bring it to the audience, how we achieve that is very personal. But here you are sharing some of these stories with everybody. I don't know where that comes from or why you have that instinct to do that right now, especially since you're still very young and you have a lot of career ahead of you, you know?
I think I experienced enough in life. Of course, in the future, I will experience more, but I think I have so much to share inside through the life experience. It was very, very tough growing up. And I already told you during the radio interviewing that I know that I am not perfect, and I am not trying to be perfect. I cannot make another Dawn of Show amazing Gretzky like she did, or like I cannot make another amazing recording like Tebaldi did, or like Mirella Freni did, or Maria Callas did. Like I cannot sing O Mio Bambino like Maria Callas or anybody else. But what I can do is I can be me, but like how me, like the most authentic me, with my own size, with my own thoughts. And the album, after the first album of I Am Hera, of course, I'm so happy and so proud of it. But I realized that there's so much better album from the past time. And why people hear me, my album? if I am not so sure about my own album, honestly, like, I think if I can be so truthful to myself every single moment in my life when I'm thinking of this album, even though at the end of the day, I'm still growing as an opera singer, my voice is still like growing and changing. It's constantly developing until a certain moment. And I realized I don't want to hear my album because I grew. But then I realized that I want to remember the feeling when I made this album. How was my feeling? Where was I? What was my insight? What was my idea? What was my energy? What was my effort and all the devotion? And I really can tell to everybody with all my confidence that this album, I did it with every, like, I didn't even leave 1% of my energy. I pour over all my heart and passion to this album. And I can confidently say it, maybe the singing after like 5-10 years later, I can say like, oh my God, I'm much better than that time. Or maybe I was good, I don't know. But I can say I was so focused and I did everything that I can possibly do in every single moment. And that will carry me forever. It's my baby. And I wanted to take good care of my baby in the most profound level. So, and I know that I am the artist who are sharing the emotions, my personality, my being, rather than just representing the music without the soul. Because I'm sure there are a lot of wonderful artists who can do this. And I am an artist, and whatever that means, I have to do it in Hera's way. And if this is Hera's way, this is where I should go.
Yeah, it certainly is a very unique album, especially in terms of the repertoire that you cover here. There's nothing like it. But I'd like to conclude talking about this photo shoot you did, or this video you did, like a plunge in a pool. I don't think we see opera singers doing this. What, free diving? Is that what you call it?
Yes. Yes, I was under the water 8
why?
Hours.
Why?
I had a dream, very, very vivid dream. I also wrote it in my album for the musical note. I had a dream that I was on the top of the mountain and certain kind of big energy came to me and touched me. So I was enlightened. It's all in the dream. And I was coming down from the top of the mountain singing Addio del Passato from La Traviata, like Bye Bye My Past. And I went all the way down to the shore and I had a deep breath in and I went under the water. But while I was walking down to the shore from the top of the mountain, there were like village people surrounded by me, as if looking at me as if I'm crazy, I'm so weirdo. And they were afraid of me. But I was so focused on my own self and I went all the way down to the water. And when I was sinking and disappeared under the water, these people started to make a big festival and had like big parties for days and days. And this dream was black and white. But when I was entering the water, the dream became a colorful dream. And I was watching all this happening, that they're having a big party and have happy time, smiling and breathing under the water. So I wondered like why I have this like vivid dream. And when I am talking about the album, about the death and the life and realization of the Cyclops epitaph of while you live, live, while you live, shine, I wanted to dig more dig into the idea, what will happen when I am being and then under the water, what will happen? And I learned how to do the free diving. And I saw myself that when you're under the water, you want to go up out of the water, because otherwise you're gonna die. So in your brain, you're constantly saying like, you're gonna die, you're gonna die. So your body is literally like pumping and like shaking. But mm-hmm. if you being you is saying, no, it's your brain who is saying that you're gonna die. Actually, you're not gonna die. You can endure it a little longer. You're not gonna die. If you're strongly saying to yourself, suddenly your body is stopping pumping and being super quiet and so calm, and you find this kind of weird stage of your ego that you're in this world or you're not in this world, somewhere in between, and only breathe is left under the water. Nothing is hearable.
And coming out of the interview, we heard that piece that Don Upshaw made famous, the Symphony of Sorrowful Songs from Henryk Gorecki. Once again, Nahara Haysang Park with the Orchestra del Teatro Carlo Felice, conducted by Jochen Rieder, in both selections from the new album, Breathe.
Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on Spotify. You click follow, Apple Podcasts, hit the plus sign. Palate-cleansing sports talk. Our Chicago Bears finally trade quarterback Justin Fields. Matt Cummings will be thrilled now that Justin Fields is going to the Pittsburgh Steelers. Fields had three seasons in Chicago. Things never really clicked. He would throw for, on average, less than 200 yards a game. This is not the franchise quarterback the Bears wanted. It looks like in the NFL draft that's coming up, we might finally get a franchise lifer quarterback that's going to bring us back to glory, provided that we have a stadium. There's a whole bunch of nonsense going on right now, but they're going to tear down Soldier Field and then rebuild it approximately 500 yards to the south.
I mean, you know, in the meantime, my building has an open lot behind it that they can use.
Send us that voice memo or email us your hot takes, mailbag@operaboxscore.com. You can even just record your thoughts using the You Got Something to Say tab on our website, operaboxscore.com, and you're going to want to do that after you hear this.
This just in, the 2-minute drill.
All right, listen up. Here's everything you need to know about what happened in Operaland this week.
The five winners of the Eric and Dominique Lafont Grand Finals concert have been selected. They are Daniel Espinal, a tenor from Sarasota, Florida, Lydia Grindato, a soprano from Tijeras, New Mexico, Navasard Hakobian, an Armenian baritone who also won the Dallas Opera Competition last week, Meridian Prahl, a mezzo-soprano from Fort Wayne, Indiana, and Emily Richter, a soprano from Arlington, Virginia. In addition to having their names read on Opera Box Score, each winner receives $20,000. The five other finalists who competed receive $10,000 and that's all.
This June, Verizon Hall at the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts in Philly will be rededicated as Marian Anderson Hall in honor of the legendary contralto, civil rights icon, and Philadelphian. It's the first major concert venue in the world to honor Anderson, 85 years after she was barred from performing at the Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C. because of her race.
And the 2024 Marian Anderson Vocal Award winner is friend of the show, Kimon Mara. The award, which recognizes outstanding young American singers, comes with a residency at Washington's Duke Ellington School of the Arts and a recital presented by Washington National Opera. Prior recipients include friends of the show, Freddie Ballantyne, Will Liverman, Solomon Howard, Speedo, and Larry Brownlee. Talk about the OBS bump.
The Bavarian State Opera and Washington National Opera have announced their 2024-2025 seasons. More after the drill.
Kathleen Battle will return to the Met for a special concert in May, her first appearance at the Met since her 2016 program, highlighting music of the Underground Railroad. The new recital features music by Purcell, Schubert, Mendelssohn, Fauré, Villa-Lobos, and Rodrigo, as well as select spirituals. Joining Battle will be harpist Bridget Kibbe and guitarist Chico Pinheiro.
Congressional Democrats have introduced a bill that would pay musicians a lot more when their music gets streamed. The Living Wage for Musicians Act would mandate that artists be paid 1 cent per stream, which doesn't sound like a lot until you consider that Spotify currently pays 0.003 of a cent per stream. It's only right that the people who create the music we love get their fair share, said Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, who is co-sponsoring the bill. We want them to thrive, not just survive.
Apollo's Fire concertmaster Alan Chu has offered an award of $2,500 for the return of his stolen violin, which went missing during a rehearsal in Cleveland last week. Chu said he would accept the return of the instrument without pressing charges or asking questions. "I'm sure there are reasons in this person's life leading up to the moment of the crime," he said. "I'm fully empathetic and understanding of that. I just want to get the instrument back because it's something that means so much to me."
In trade news, Esa-Pekka Salonen will be leaving the San Francisco Symphony over disagreements with the board of directors. Salonen's tenure focused on premieres and collaborations with contemporary artists, something that seems to have been at odds with the board's worries about post-pandemic budget shortfalls.
Another major conductor is stepping down on the West Coast. James Conlin has announced that he will end his position as music director for the Los Angeles Opera in 2026 during the company's 40th anniversary season. Quote, "I've had 20 years. That's a good round number," said Conlin. "I want to stop when I'm at my full capacity, and I want to be able to go on loving the company the way I do."
Before he gets bitter, he needs to say.
Exit stage right. Canadian opera director Michael Cavanaugh has died at 62. After training to be a singer, he switched career paths to direct more than 150 operas over a 34-year career. In addition to directing, Cavanaugh wrote an opera called Gisela in Her Bathtub and City Workers in Love.
I think that might be Gisela, but that's okay. It's not that important.
You're doing your best.
American soprano Margaret Tynes has died at the age of 104. A child prodigy, she became a prominent international soloist in title roles such as Lady Macbeth, Aida, Norma, Tosca, Salome, and Bess. Tynes even became the first American singer to perform behind the Iron Curtain on a tour with the U.S. State Department and Ed Sullivan.
German composer Aribert Reimann has died at 88. Reimann was known for his operas based on famous works of literature, such as Medea, Troades after Euripides' The Trojan Women, and Lear after Shakespeare's King Lear. He received numerous accolades over a half century of operatic composition, including the 2011 Ernst von Siemens Music Prize.
And on this day, March 18th, it was the birth of soprano Maria Now, an American singer who sang in the premieres of operas by Alavi, Niedermeyer, Auber, and Adam. In 1823, it was the first performance of Saverio Mercadante's Gli Scitti. I kid you not. In 1831, tenor José Dupuy was born in Liège. He created the role of Paris in Offenbach's Belle Hélène and other Offenbach roles. In 1844, it was the birth of Russian composer Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov. Giovanni Pacini's Alan Cameron, an opera seria, premiered in 1848. Gianfrancesco Malipiero was born in Venice on this day in 1882, as was German tenor Rudolf Laubenthal in Dusseldorf in 1886. In 1898, soprano Ophelia Nieto was born in Santiago de Compostela. In 1910, it was the first opera by an American composer performed at the Met, Frederick Shepherd Converse's The Pipe of Desire.
That we all know and love.
Exactly, a banger. In 1929, it was the birth of American-based John McCurdy, who was born in Detroit. Lottie Riesenek, the sister of Lanny Riesenek, was also born this day in 1929. In 1933, bass baritone Edward Allen Baird was born in Kansas City, and happy birthday to the about-to-retire American conductor James Conlon, born March 18th in 1950.
That is your two-minute drill.
Just a little bit of Margaret Tynes singing the card scene from Carmen.
George, it's been so long since you've been in charge. I literally almost said, and that's your two-minute drill. Like, the muscle memory has worked its way in there.
Good for you, man. I love that stepping up. That's phenomenal. Wow, lots of great stuff happening this week in Opera Land. We just need to rep it here in the Midwest. Meridian Prawl out of Fort Wayne, Indiana, one of the winners of the LaFont Grand Finals. Way to go, Midwest.
We did it.
We collectively did it. We you know, we got together all the cheese curds and, like, you know, got it all in the vocal cords and, you know.
Corn, baby.
It was great.
Well, actually, I'm glad you said that because I sort of want to tease what we're going to be doing for the next couple of weeks with March Madness. Mm. I'd like all of you, audience, to think about how people learn how to sing, what institutions they go to, and which institutions maybe best represent the School of American Singing.
I can definitely think of one in the state of Indiana. Marian Anderson, this is such a big deal that one of the venues inside of the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts in Philadelphia being rededicated here 85 years after Marian Anderson is barred from singing at Constitution Hall.
This is one of those stories that we kept missing. This happened a while ago, but it really is worth talking about. Marian Anderson, I feel like, is having such a moment lately. I mean, she's always been so iconic in for like a very sort of small sort of niche part of the opera world, which I think we are all a part of. But more and more, I'm seeing her recognized, referenced outside of the classical music world, you know, talking about more people in sort of the first wave of the civil rights movement prior to the, you know, 50s and 60s. And it's really, really exciting. And it's infinitely better than Verizon Hall. So that's a win as well.
Congrats to our friend Kimon Marah. That's going to be a great opportunity for him. I think his star is rising so fast, and it's great for him to, like, just have some time with the Duke Ellington School for the Arts. I imagine that's a high school for him to, like, you know, just do something that's more than one, you know, one performance and off you go. Like, just to be, to have a relationship with some young singers and for them to be inspired by his voice, first of all.
Yeah.
But also at how young he is and how, you know, it's possible to get this much attention when you're this young. It really is inspiring. And to be such a great, I mean, he's really an outstanding singer. Like, he really understands his voice. He understands the history of singing. He understands performing. He's just so inspiring.
He's such a great ambassador for the art form too. Yeah. You know, ever since, you know, we interviewed him, you know, we became friends on Facebook, and he's just, like, you know, so open and genuine about everything. And upbeat. I can't think of anyone more deserving just for that alone.
Yeah.
And may I just say for a moment, the OBS to Marian Anderson Vocal Award pipeline is still going strong.
Very strong.
We missed Justin Austin, but I'm still hoping he'll get on the show.
Statistically, it's impactful, you know.
Yes.
Well, okay, before we get to the Bavarian State Opera and Washington National Opera announcements, I just want to touch on Kathleen Battle.
Yes, yes.
I don't know how many stories I've told over the years about Kathleen Battle on this show and on my other platform, but you have to check her out in recital. I mean, she is so extra all the time, and I love how extra she is. There's always a story that comes out of one of her performances about something that she has done, something that delayed the concert.
Yeah.
And I love it. It's like, I miss this kind of like drama. Yes, exactly.
Drama attached to such an amazing voice. She's such a formative singer for me. Like, you know, I think I've told the story before how when I was a baby, not to reveal my age too much, when I was a baby and upset, the only thing that would calm me down would be my parents going on and turning on whatever the latest Kathleen Battle album was. So I heard her voice more than, you know, any other voice aside from my parents in my very early years. And there is still something so magical to it. And, you know, she's been, you know, very much sort of outside the performing space for a long time. She did have this one concert in 2016, but it's been a long time since 2016. But, you know, when a voice like that comes back, regardless of the drama surrounding it, you got to go check it out.
You go. Right? I mean, absolutely.
The irony is that, you know, she was fired from the Met famously for her antics. Meanwhile, the conductor,
person who fired her. I mean, the tables have turned. Kathleen is ready for a comeback, you know, and I'm here for it.
But I bet, I'm not a betting man, but I bet that this performance will sell out very fast.
Maybe absolutely.
Within a day of tickets going on sale. So
we should get PJ to try and go.
Are we going to talk about streaming?
I mean, I think it's pretty self-explanatory. I think this is, in its current form, a good bill. I think it'll probably go through a lot of changes between now and if it ever becomes a law. It is, you know, frankly insulting what the standards are for how much artists get paid. I believe it was something like 80. The article that I was reading from where I found that story was 800,000 plays is the equivalent of, is the equivalent of like $15 or something like that, or something like a super small number. You can do the math at home. I won't pretend, but this is something that's been such a problem for such a long time as we move farther and farther away from physical media. So that only the super, super, famous can really earn real money off of streaming. So this is super important. 1 cent, I feel like, is a lot of money. That's going to be a big gear change. I think it's something to work towards. I think if this goes through, it'll probably end up being less than that. But we do need legislation to up that price for sure.
Aren't the people who founded Spotify, I think they're men, aren't they from Sweden?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel like the Swedes are very equitable people. And the 0.03 of a cent thing, I just like...
I blame Sweden specifically at all of our Swedish listeners.
Anyway, I wanted to say that I know Alan Chu, and I'm actually, I have a relationship with the Paulus Fire, and they just released a brand new album of Alan Chu playing the Heinrich Bieber mystery sonatas, I think, on the very violin.
Oh my goodness.
That was stolen. So this is, I mean, I don't know what the people who steal violins think they're going to get away with. It's like, it's not really the type of, it's not like stealing an iPhone where you can get it like unlocked and like reset.
Right, yeah. You know? If you are a violin thief and you're listening right now, you know, it really does not behoove you.
It's
because
not worth it.
Old violins like this are so well documented. Like the moment you try to sell it, the moment someone sees what it is, it's going to be, they're going to know, you know, it's going to be obvious. Just give it back, you know? I think she was being so nice about this, you know. I know, you know, as an amateur, you know, instrumentalist, occasionally I would be devastated if someone stole my instrument. And I am not on the level of anyone at Apollo Spire, much less the concertmaster. But, you know, it really feels like your arm is missing if you can't find your instrument. You know, I had a moment where I left my clarinet on a bus once, and just the sheer panic, and I ran after it, and luckily they stopped. And I'm a very much an amateur. I am not a good clarinetist. You don't want to hear me play, but it is
part of you. It was part of you. We will get to those season announcements in a second. I want to jump down to James Conlon leaving Los Angeles Opera in 2026. So I'm not sure which is more surprising, that the company has only been around for 40 years, or that James Conlon has been at LA Opera for half of those 40 years.
That is pretty wild. LA has such a huge reputation. You do think of it as being an older company, but, you know, it is still, you know, I mean, for the U.S., it's a fairly old company, but on the grand scheme of things, it's pretty new. And that's why I think their rep tends to be so interesting, because, you know, it didn't have a lot of the same pressures that some other companies did that were around longer. But what a career.
And for LA Opera to become such a player in America's opera scene from a city like Los Angeles, where everything revolves around the film industry, to become relevant in just 40
That's
years.
Hard.
And it's hard, right? And Conlon, I think, is to his credit, is a large part of that, right? Again, 20 years of working to try and make this opera company what it is today as an absolute tier A house is really quite extraordinary.
Esa-Pekka Salonen, on the other hand, you know, was only there for 4 years at the San Francisco Symphony before he tapped out. And listen, I love Esa-Pekka Salonen. I think that he had a very, I think, coherent vision for the symphony, which does have, I will say, an extremely large endowment that included a lot of like fairly edgy stuff. But this ties in, I think, you know, this is an opera, but it ties in with the sort of the theme that we've been hitting over the past, you know, year or two of large musical organizations in the classical world trying to find that line between, can we afford all this new weird work? Do we need to go back to the boring, you know, sort of old fart kind of repertoire? Or is there an in-between? Do we want the prestige of someone like Esa-Pekka Salonen saying that we're going to go forward while still behind the scenes pushing him to stick with more manageable repertoire? How much of a financial shortfall are we really in? Do we just need some more creative rebudgeting? No.
He seems to be the conductor for the 2019-2020 season. And now post 2020, all arts organizations are rethinking, you know, how do they manage loss, essentially. And Esa-Pekka Salonen, I don't think, thinks that way. I don't think he wants to go backwards, you know.
No,
yeah, just try to stop him, you know. So
that's very much his vibe. Like, if you've ever heard him in concert, that's you know, he's very much a new music person. He's done some of his own compositions too, I believe. You know, he thinks, based on what I know of him, and I would agree if this is what he thinks, that a city like San Francisco with a large symphony, with a really solid endowment, really big budget, should be at the forefront, you know, and it feels, you know, and again, he is also European, so, you know, grain of salt with maybe what the Americans are able to do, but it is certainly, I could see that leading to a lot of tension behind the scenes.
Okay, so at long last, we've been teasing it. What's going on at Washington National Opera?
Weston, you take this one, and then I'll set up the Bavarian State Opera.
We got a few things going on at Washington National Opera. They have four operas this season. They're doing Fidelio, directed by friend of the show, Francesca Zambello, which is a staging that was actually going to happen before, you know, 2020, and then everything happened. Sinead Campbell-Wallace, she's making her American debut this season. James McCorkle, Denise Graves is going to be in there as Don Fernando.
That's weird.
That is odd.
She's singing a baritone role? I don't get it.
So. I don't really get that either. That's what this says. It could be completely wrong.
No, it could be just like a no. All fucked up type of casting. You know,
yeah,
so. Yeah. I mean, I'm interested. It sounds like, you know, Zambello is, as we know, very good at pulling interest out of older work. So maybe this is part of it. We also have Macbeth. Yes, with Eva Plonka. Who's a soprano. I don't know her at all, but
yes,
I love...
Yes, you do. Yeah, you've...
I do?
That's a name that's certainly been on the show before, yeah.
Oh, really? It was one of the ones I missed. I'm sorry.
And if I know who that singer is, then obviously it's got to be somebody important.
He doesn't even know five handle operas.
The bar is so low when it comes to me and singers. So just you wait till I get to the Bavarian State Opera thing, though.
We also have Canadian baritone Etienne Dupuis, who is making a role debut in that opera as well as Macbeth. We also have The Revolution of Steve Jobs, always a fun time. It's the Mason Bates opera, followed by another Francesca Zambello staging of Porgy and Bess. And we'll hear Michael Schmuel and Reginald Smith Jr. As Porgy and Brittany Renee and Allison Cambridge as Bess. And then the sort of the new opera of the season, again, a fairly short season here, we have a Kamala Sankaram opera based on The Jungle Book, which is is being advertised right now, at least, as a sort of Bollywood style family friendly show. And I'm quite interested to see that, actually. I think that that Jungle Book would be a really fun family opera. And I don't think we've had a lot of really good kid-friendly operas come out in the last 20 years. So I think this is an exciting platform. Hopefully it turns out as good as it is in my head.
If you're Mason Bates, who composed Revolution of Steve Jobs, you are absolutely thrilled right now. Nobody can tell me that this was going to become one of the more produced operas of the 21st century, right?
You underestimate how much people love their phones because you're never on the internet.
That's very true. But listen to this, right? Santa Fe Opera, Atlanta Opera, Austin Opera, San Francisco Opera, Seattle Opera, and now Washington National Opera have all done this show.
So to round out the season, there's going to be a couple of concerts, Christine Gerke and Brendan Jovanovic in Music by Wagner in concert, and then an American opera program with Renee Fleming, Denise Graves, and Thomas Hampson.
The most American opera recital collection of people I've ever heard in my life.
But just to, you know, step back, we have, you know, German Romantic Opera in Fidelio, an early Verdi with the Macbeth, the Steve Jobs show, and the Porgy and Bess. So two for American opera. So there's a healthy mix of standards and, you know, 20th century and 21st century. And you add in the Jungle Book, you add in your female composer. So we see that Francesca is really, you know, trying to stick to her guns with inclusivity and the... I mean, she said on our interview that we did, we broadcast about the importance of making opera family friendly, not just to create a pipeline of new audience members, but also because we want children to come to the opera generally. And how are you going to get them to come if they don't see themselves on stage, if they don't, you know, feel like they're represented any other way, you know, like it can't just be the children's chorus from Carmen, you know?
I don't think you can legally take your 5-year-old to Salome.
No, sure. Yeah, exactly. Moving over to Munich, the Bavarian State Opera. And if you haven't been, the Bavarian State Opera has to be one of the most opulent houses in Europe after Paris, I would say, probably. When you look at these names that are singing there, the shows that they're being led, the directors, you realize that you are in such a different level. It's like you've been watching single A baseball your entire life, and then you go and watch a Major League Baseball game. Or it's like you're watching like crummy, you know, farm team hockey, and you watch an NHL game, and you're like, God, these guys are fast. So this is insane. So there's 9 new productions this year.
That's just new productions. That like blows the amount of total operas for like San Fran out of the water.
I don't even think the Met has 9 new productions, right? Isn't this the Met season this year is the lowest number of productions?
Yeah, it's shrunk,
since the 80s. Exactly. And I'm just going to sit here and read names because you can go look it up yourselves. But as a director, when I look at the roster of directors that are here, Tobias Kratzer, Damiano Micheletto, Klaus Gut. I thought Klaus Gut was dead, by the way, but apparently not. Who else is on here? Lotte Vanderberg. It's just, it's overwhelming the amount of talent in one space at one time. A couple of premieres here. Matsukaze, a new opera. Das Jagdgewehr, also a new opera. And then you have some more, traditional, it's all relative, but certainly some inherited repertoire here. And a couple of outsiders. Strauss's Die Liebe der Danae. I don't know who does that.
It's underrated, but it's pretty good.
Fauré's Penelope.
I didn't even know Fauré did an opera, I'll be honest. Yeah.
I can't say anymore. I'm just like so overwhelmed by the amount of talent.
I do want to point out that they are doing Karl Orff's Der Mond, which is a great show.
It's so good. It's a revival. Yep.
I love that one. And you got Oskana Leonieff is conducting Tosca. They're doing like Die Tote Stadt, you know, Le Grand Macabre. Are you kidding? But conducted by Kent Nagano. What a great combo that is.
This may be Lisa Davidson's role debut as Tosca. I know she's recorded excerpts of it, but.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
And that's with friend of the show, Freddie DiTommaso. Oh, not really. He's not a friend of the show, is he? Well, he's a friend of my other show.
Future friend.
Sir Bryn Terfel.
It's just an absolute beast of a season. Cunning Little Vixen. I'm just literally scrolling through and just seeing what all is cool.
Stop, Weston. I can't take it.
Obviously, Le Grand Macabre is the highlight of the season. I don't think anyone will push back at me about that. But, it is a reminder that, it is a different beast over there, especially in the heart of Germany. And, you know, I was reminded of that even in Frankfurt when I was there a few weeks ago, just the amount and, sheer scale of everything.
It's overwhelming.
That's the power of like subsidized arts. That's what it boils down to. And I think if you are an at all political person, dear listener, and you are listening, this is a cause you can fight for, is to try to get federal funding, state funding back into the arts, because this is what we can have.
We'll link to the Opera Wire write-up of the Bavarian State Opera season and put that write-up in the show notes for today's episode.
In the meantime, let's wrap this show up.
Good call, bad call on Opera Box Score.
Good call, bad call is how we are going to finish things off on our episode this week. We're going to start with Oliver Camacho.
So as we were wrapping up the interview, Hera and I, we start to lose a good internet connection. But she was in the middle of describing her free diving photo shoot / music video. And we're going to go ahead and add that video to the website. So you can see that. And if you just imagine do you know any other opera singer who would put on, a ball gown and then dive into a pool and allow themselves to be filmed looking as serene as possible? I mean, like, I think there are, trained actors who wouldn't do that because that seems really scary to me. But she did it. So congratulations to her.
Good call from me as well. This is a clip on YouTube Shorts from the Jimmy Kimmel Show, where they edited together clips of NFL players and then I think somehow put an opera soundtrack to it. It's absolutely hilarious. The link is going to be on the website as well, operaboxscore.com. I don't have much of a sense of humor, and I thought that thing was so darn funny. That's it for this week's edition of America's Talk Radio Show about opera. Make sure you subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Get your voice heard and find links to stuff we've talked about at our website, operaboxscore.com. And that's also where you can put your money where our mouths are. Give back to the OBS using the Support the Team tab. Hey, Catherine, thanks for donating. Your announcer is Norm Waddell. Your creative consultant is Oliver Camacho. And your audio editor is Weston Williams. For our guest, Hera Haesang Park, I'm George Cedarquist, asking you to continue the conversation about opera as you stop when you're at full capacity. We're back with an all-new show next week when March Madness hits opera land. Plus, you get more opera headlines, more hot takes, and more pennies for every 1,000 streams. Join us.